come join the conversation, the show that you've been wanting. Keep it real with no filter, weekly we share discussions. WWSD, interviewing creative guests, talking the creative process and sharing all the influences from TV and film. Emmy nominated and winning, yeah, they coming through. Actors and comedians too, directors and writers, way more than a few. Masters of their craft, yes, tune in, you gotta see. This the podcast that you need, WWSD.
Welcome to the WWSD podcast. Weekly, we share discussions with interesting and creative people. I'm your host, Josh, and as always, I'm joined by my buddy and co-host, Seamus. How are you doing tonight, Seamus?
Doing great, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
You had a good week?
Yeah, it was all right.
It was all right.
I'm more excited for my weekend.
Who do we have on tonight?
Tonight, we have a very special, cool guest. We are joined by cinematographer, writer, and director, Tiffany Murray. Tiffany is the creator of an exciting new sci-fi adventure podcast, Southridge. She's also our first cinematographer and kind of person that's worked in cameras and all that cool side of film and television. And we're super excited to talk to her tonight. Tiffany, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing tonight?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
Can you give us a little bit of overview of how you got into the industry?
I grew up just like shooting pictures. My grandmother gave me my first camera when I was like 11 or so, and I just was attached to it. Like it was always with me. And so I knew I wanted to do something with cameras. And I didn't know what that was, what existed out there that happened to do with cameras. And I went to this college thinking, oh, they've got a good broadcast program. Maybe I'll work for like a news station or something. That's like the closest to what I could imagine working with cameras as a career was. And then I kind of like fell into a student-run organization that made short films and music videos and stuff and was like, oh, this is it. It was like immediate, like there's so many people with all these different talents and they just come together and make this beautiful thing from someone's brain.
You do a lot of different things in the industry. Like when people ask you what you do, like what do you tell them?
So it changes. Throughout the last year, I've kind of had a pretty big career shift. So now I'm a director, writer, DP. And then on the side, I help produce projects. And then also I'm a production manager at a production company.
Okay.
So lots of hyphenates.
And from the transition of like college, like shooting those videos, like how'd you start like directing and producing?
So through our film guild at our college, we were able to direct and produce our own shorts. And so you start off as a PA, not knowing anything, just volunteering on these sets. And then when you are a junior and senior, you're able to like, hey, I want to produce this project. Who wants to work for free with me to make it? So I started, my first official short film was with that group. And then from there, I was like, okay, this is really cool. How do I save up money to do this again? So just kind of like delve from there. I'll work really hard as an AC or, you know, whatever my job was at the time, save that money so that I can produce my own projects. And now I'm like, okay, I'm done producing my own projects. Who wants to pay me?
And those early years, like what were you shooting? Like what was the thing you were going for?
I was still figuring it out. I have always been drawn to drama and sci-fi, but I've shot comedies, I've shot music videos, documentaries. There's something magical about every different genre and style of filming. And so just like figuring out what I'm drawn to and why, like I'm working on this ongoing documentary right now and I love it. And it's completely different than anything else I'm doing. That makes it fun because, you know, I've got this sci-fi series and I've got this coming of age script that I'm writing and then this random documentary on a runner. Very different things, but they're all enticing different ways.
When you're working in the camera, like on camera, how different is it to film like sci-fi drama, like these different genres? How would you be able to tell the difference between somebody who's just kind of new at it and someone who's really seasoned?
The nuts and bolts are all the same. You know, it's like, okay, here's a camera, here's a lens, put them together and you can shoot. But what shifts is like when someone's really into sci-fi, even if they don't recognize it, they're pulling from things like Blade Runner. They're referencing things without realizing it because they're so immersed in it that they're pulling all of these different old school techniques or styles or color palettes into their work. And I think that's where you start to see like, oh, that was an ode to this and that was an ode to this. And maybe the filmmaker meant to do it or maybe they just did it. But that's definitely like an indicator for me.
Like from the actual like working the cameras, I know like on your IMDb, a lot of your credits are for like first assistant camera. Mm-hmm. What does that actually mean?
I pull focus. So I tell the audience what to look at and when. That's the easiest way to describe it, in my opinion. So basically, I'm in charge of the camera department, making sure that my operator is happy and that we have the right lenses, the right filters, all of that, and then managing the people on me as well. But my main thing is making sure that the shot's in focus. So that involves like, you've got a follow focus and a monitor and you're constantly like taking marks and talking with the actors, making sure like, oh, you're going to take a step forward at the end of the scene. Got it. And make sure you have the mark for that.
What kind of information are you receiving from the director when you're doing this?
It's a lot of like, just stand near them and listen in. A lot of times directors don't turn straight to the first and say like, hey, this is going to happen. But on like larger shows, they'll do a blocking rehearsal and then crew-wide rehearsal where anyone who wants to watch can watch. And they've figured out where all the actors are going to be. So the actors go through those movements and the second ACs will lay marks where the actors need to be. And then as a first, that person is taking note of like, oh, okay, so John is going to walk 5 feet that way. So let me see where the camera is and measure from the camera to that mark and the camera to that mark so that I can match that on my follow focus.
Is there a lot of like measuring and like math and stuff?
Yes and no. I hate math, so I like to not think of it as math, but it kind of is. I mean, like for me, it's more of once I get in sync with an actor, especially on a show, it's really fun. Oh, I know they're going to kind of lean forward as they say that juicy line. It's more emotional, in my opinion. You're following the actor through their movements. But some people think of it as math. I know that a typical lean in is a foot and a half. 2 feet is like they're going to stand up, swooping in. It's like weird stuff like that. And then from a sitting position to a standing position, it can be between 2 and 3 feet.
It kind of reminds me of like bartenders, because like bartenders don't like, they're like, yeah, it's like 1.5 ounces. They just look at it and all. Right. It sounds like, yes. Kind of like, yeah, it's 1.5 feet. That's awesome.
When I started ACing, I had a laser measure. And I would just like sit in rooms and measure like, okay, that wall is 8 feet. That's what 8 feet looks like. That wall is 16 feet. That's what 16 feet looks like. And so throughout ACing, I kind of started getting this idea of I could not look at a monitor at all. And as long as I have the right marks on my follow focus, I could say, okay, 6 to 8 to 15 inches back to 20 feet. I kind of like have that. At least I could get close. And then look at my monitor to make sure.
You mentioned a little bit, like kind of have to listen in and get a feel for what the director's vision is. Where's the barrier between like what you know and what the director knows when they're communicating? Like, do you have to have like a really good idea of like of the scene and like what how do you communicate that?
It depends on the director. I've worked with directors that have been ACs. And so that they're going to say like, hey, I want you to pull focus to this thing. And then I've worked with directors who walked right in from their cubicle and have no idea what focus means. There's a big level of adjustment there of like, I think that this is the right thing to do here and I'm going to try that. But a lot of times it's the director of photography that I'm like, hey, should I do this? And then they communicate for the director. Unless the director is a DP as well. And then there's a lot of, it depends because, you know, so many people work in different ways that it's up to the dynamic of the crew to figure out where you should interject and where you should just say, yes, sir. And do your job, you know.
Is all the focus that you're doing manual with these cameras nowadays? Is there anything automatic that you're doing?
So manual and wireless are the two options. There are some like automatic autofocus kinds of things that exist and are starting to become a thing. But in my opinion, because focus pulling is so emotional, no robot's going to be able to tell like, oh, I'm going to rack focus to the person in the foreground at the end of this because they're crying. That's something that you just have to witness and feel out versus a computer just like saying, this is the most important thing. But manual in our terms, when you just have a gear on the side of the camera that you're like pulling, so your hand is basically attached to the camera versus a wireless follow focus. So you can be off in your own little dark corner away from all of the lights and everything.
So I've heard like directors like Zack Snyder, he's like really particular about certain lenses and certain shots. Mm. Is that a common thing across the field with like working with directors where they really want like something done like their way or like a very explicit way? And it's like something that you might not be comfortable with or something you're used to.
So when I've worked as a DP, a lot of times it's kind of me saying to the director, hey, I think this script should be shot with these old 70s lenses because we want warmer texture feel versus a comedy, which, or a commercial where you're going to want like really crispy clinical glass. And so I think it's a little bit of the DP asking the director and then kind of collaborating together on what the overall look is. And then it's the DP's job to interpret, okay, this is what the look is. How do I get there? They're doing research and sending lens tests to the director and whoever else is making creative decisions on this is the lens that we want to use.
And even like the lenses themselves and in general, like the technology, like, is it like a constantly changing field or is like you said, like lenses from the 70s, is it kind of stagnant in that sense?
I mean, there's always new lenses being made and, you know, there's different things being done with lenses. There's a fad right now where like TikTok people are like scratching rocks on the front of lenses to make it like look really bloomy.
Is that really a thing?
Yeah, I saw this and I was just like, oh no.
I figured it'd be a filter for that or something. That's
real wasteful.
Yeah, exactly. There are filters for that. People just don't know about it.
Kids.
There's a lot of people that will say like new glass is overrated. I'm going to go back to the 60s through 80s lenses. That's my jam. And then there's new things being done all the time with brand new companies coming out. Their lenses are just phenomenal. So it really just depends on the person. There's a lot of people that will get stuck in their ways. I only shoot with these lenses.
Yeah.
And it's like, yes, but have you tried anything else? You know, like there's a level of, hey, why don't you experiment a little bit versus being just stuck in your ways. But if someone has the right thing and that's what they like, then good for them, you know.
You did mention experimenting. Like how much like opportunity is there to experiment? I know like television is a much tighter deadline for a lot of these productions. Do you actually get like the opportunity to like to test different focuses and different lenses?
There's a lot of lens test videos online. Like I could go up and compare 10 different lenses on some website and be able to send three of those to my director, say, hey, I like the look of these three. What do you think? And then if you have time, what's great is going into a rental house and shooting with your exact camera, the exact settings that you want for your show, and then like trying out these lenses in different lighting scenarios or on different skin tones. Different like movements, you know, some lenses bow on the corners. And so then you have like a weird distortion. And if you're doing a lot of off center framing, that might not be a good thing for you, you know. But yeah, it just depends on the project. Sometimes it's a short film and you have 6 months of prep and can go in and test every lens possible. And sometimes you're shooting the next day and show up and shoot with the lens that they have.
You did mention lighting as well, because that also does play a pretty big part in what you're doing. I'm assuming that it's a different department, right? Lighting department's
created. Yeah.
Okay. So how do you guys kind of like communicate and coordinate to kind of get these shots done?
So a director of photography is kind of like the visual director. And then under them is the camera department and the grip and lighting department. Sometimes they're grip and lighting, and sometimes they're smushed together. So the DP will collaborate with the director, figure out the look, and then translate that to their gaffer, who's the head of the lighting and grip team, and then their operators and ACs. So you have the lighting and grip team, which again, it depends on the working dynamic. My gaffer, I show him some stills and I say, hey, maybe we'd like to use these lights and I want to try this weird thing with color. And then he goes off and finds the best tools for the job. Other DPs are like, I want this light with this amount of diffusion and I want to put it right here this high. Again, it just depends on the different people in the crew and how they like to work together.
And even like when you're shooting on sets, I know there's occasionally like more than one camera. Mm-hmm. And like not even just that, like different teams as well. Like some movies are shot in LA and then for the first half, and then they're shot in like Atlanta for like the next half or overseas or whatever. How does that translate with the camera department trying to do the same like thing? I mean, I'm sure with different teams, it's kind of hard.
Yeah, sometimes production will send a representative from the LA team to Tokyo or wherever they're shooting the splinter unit stuff. sometimes they'll send a bunch of stills like, hey, this is what we shot. Make sure you match it. A lot of DPs, I've worked with a couple that when they bring on new operators, whether they're on set with them or not, we'll send them like some visual references. Hey, we're going to go for the like Clint Eastwood Western look. So I would suggest like watching these two movies, noticing how they frame. Stuff like that is really helpful. There's a new site called Shot Deck right now that basically you can look up yellow centered two people and it'll pull up 100,000 frames of just different things that match those keywords. And so that's been a really exciting thing in the last couple of years where directors and DPs and anyone can just go in and say, this is what I'm looking for. Because a lot of newer DPs or directors can't verbally translate what they're asking for. And so to be able to send a frame and say, this is the thing.
That's really cool.
Helps a lot with like, I've worked personally with a lot of directors who come from the acting world. And so like being able to say, okay, I hear what you're saying, but I don't think you want what you're saying. And being able to say like, this is what you're saying. And this is what I think you want. Is that right? You know, going back and forth. So you're not having these discussions on set while you're wasting time and you're paying all of your actors and crew to be there.
Sounds really helpful.
Yeah.
And you also do directing. I mean, is it easier like working with like other like DPs and all and in a directing seat?
I feel really fortunate to have so much experience on set that I can bring into my DPing and directing because I can say like, listen, I understand how hard sound mixing is. I tried that and I don't do sound because it's really hard, you know? And so like being able to understand other people's jobs, one, just makes you appreciate that person who can do it well, but two, helps you have like this vocabulary to discuss with them. Like, I'm going to go see the art director about this thing because it's something on the wall versus a prop person that's going to handle things that the actors are touching. Knowing who to talk to and how to talk to them about what is really helpful after working on so many sets and just seeing how everything flows.
It seems like a lot of directors, they have some kind of, they start out somewhere in the film industry. Some people are actors, some people are working on other things.
I think it's like, pretty hard just starting as a director.
Well, Yeah, obviously. It's interesting. Like what when you come to become a director, like you're bringing a different skill set than somebody who might have like started from acting. Mm-hmm. Like what are some things that when you jump into directing that maybe are challenges for you because of your background as opposed to someone else?
I've actually co-directed a couple of times with wonderful, talented friend of mine, Amy, and she comes from the acting world and also the editing world. And so when she's watching a performance, she's looking at the actor's emotional journey and how they're moving their body. And I'm like, yeah, that looks good in frame. And sometimes forget about like, oh, there's an actor that I'm supposed to be paying attention to. And so it was great to have that co-directing experience so that I could almost shadow her. And then I would say to her, like, hey, we need to do that again. The camera was not in the right position or whatever it was. So I think like working with actors is a weakness of mine that other people who maybe come from the acting world have a leg up on. But you know, there's always room for growth in any skill. If you're perfect at it, you should go find something else to do. So it's always a challenge. But that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this podcast was I don't have to think about anything visual. It's just how the actor says it. So getting to like tweak these lines over and over again was a lot of fun, but also just a boot camp in how to get what I want from the actor.
That's a good segue. That's into your podcast. Where did that kind of like come from?
It's Southbridge, by the way. It's very good. Enjoyed it.
Honestly, so when I was in middle school, I watched some video about Foley art and I thought it was fascinating and then never thought about it again. And then I got into the film industry and that memory kind of came back and I was like, yeah, sound design is wild. But where Southbridge came from, I wrote and directed a short film called I'll Be Here, now available on Amazon Prime. And while doing that, I was like, I'm really interested in this like last man on earth kind of thing, which I know is a fad and like overdone, but I was like, how do I do this and make it more unique? Add some twists in there and, you know, different things that I enjoy from various shows and movies. And it kind of just started transforming into a series. And originally it was a TV series. And I was like, okay, shoot for the stars here and see what happens. But as I started developing it, I realized this is an expensive series and no one's going to pay little old me to make this series. So when the pandemic hit, it kind of all fell into place of like, what if I just did the audio part? You know, I was a big fan of Homecoming when it came out, podcast turned into a TV show. And I was like, what if I just copy that route? And now so many different audio dramas are doing the same thing. But it was so exciting to be able to film or record even just the audio of it, because I'm just so excited about the story. And it's like, I know this is good. People will like it, but I have to gain some interest. I'm hoping that through making a podcast, I can then prove that there's an audience for this and pitch it as a TV show.
Can you kind of give an overview of the like theme and story of Southbridge?
Southbridge is a story about a group of people who think they've survived an apocalyptic event. And it turns out that they're not necessarily in the apocalypse and that there's some outside forces controlling what happens to them.
You know, when you're filming something, there's a lot of information that is already there in like on screen, like for setting the scene, like you kind of understand, you know, what the climate is, like where you are, like the state of things. How do you transition, like when you're doing an audio drama, to kind of grip people in and set the scene in that way, like and convey the imagery, if you will, like of the story?
I think that's the ultimate challenge with audio drama, is how to tell the whole story when you can only hear it. When I first started writing, I was like, don't think about hearing it. I mean, a little bit think about hearing it, but just write the story. And then we did several passes of how can I hear this? You know, so they're walking into a concrete room full of people. How does that sound? Echoes, there's flashing cameras, there's, you know, a crowd outside. And then like differentiating different areas, like different locations, came in a lot with my sound designer, Seth Kays, where he was like, okay, well, I imagine the command center has this kind of tone versus outside is going to have this kind of tone. So it's really just like that side of directing. I'm going to tell you what I can, and then I'm going to let you take the reins and pitch what you're hearing, and then we can kind of meet somewhere in the middle.
How is the dialogue affected as well? I imagine that would be a little bit different than if you had something on film.
With screenwriting, they always say show, don't tell. And so taking that into consideration, it was really difficult. How do I show, don't tell, but with audio? So it's either sound effects of like, oh, someone's walking up behind them, or dropping in little things here and there so you know who they're talking to in the room. Hey, Kathy, blah, 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 blah. Instead of, hey, you're an asshole, you know, like... Who's an asshole? I'm not sure. So there are some lines of dialogue that had been adjusted just to make sure that everyone knew what's going on. That would definitely change if it were a visual medium.
Was there any point when you were recording these things, you listened to it back, you're like, well, I can't tell what's going on here. We need to redo this. Or did you have a pretty good sense of things when you started out?
It wasn't necessarily me that couldn't tell, because I had written a story. Mm-hmm. And then was rewriting it and directing it. Like, I've been hearing this whole 280-page script for 3 years at this point. And so in my mind, everything makes complete sense. So that's when I started bringing in my producer, Amy, and Seth, and some other trusted friends, and just asking like, does this make sense to you? Because even in script writing, I'll write a short and I know exactly what's happening, and then send it to someone and be like, where am I? And I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot that part. You know, there's different things that make sense in my head that don't necessarily translate. I think that's one of the hardest things as a writer, to fully craft what you're thinking and put it into words.
Because as a writer, like you know, like the scene, like it's already in your head,
right?
And then like you having to write that for someone else, yeah, that's interesting.
This seems like an interesting skill, like understanding what information you haven't put on the page that, yeah, that just exists within you, right?
I know exactly what a SIG is, but in the first episode, no one knows what a SIG is. So how do I, one, spell out subdermally implanted gateway device, and then also explain what it is, where it is, what it does, you know, all of these things that in my head, SIG, instant. I know, especially with sci-fi, I think that's the really hard thing, is making up a world that's different enough that it's entertaining, but not so out there that people are lost.
In the genre of sci-fi, I feel like a lot of it's like overly cliche. Like, is that hard writing like sci-fi because like, oh, this show did it or this movie did this already? Like, it has to be very hard.
Yeah, I hesitated on a couple things, the data chip implants being one of them, for so long. I was like really fighting it. How else can I make this thing happen without having a data chip? And I kept trying different things and was like, you know what? I have to give in. But how do I make it unique? There's 7 stories, they say. And every time you tell a story, it's just an iteration of one of these 7. And that statement has been debated a lot. But it's the same thing with sci-fi. Like, everything's been done. How are you going to do it different? What are you going to bring to the table that other people haven't?
The stuff that hasn't been done, probably, it might not be relatable.
Right.
Everything that's been done has been done because, like, that's what people can digest, I imagine.
There's a reason people keep watching Star Trek.
Because a lot of sci-fi is based on, like, potential real-life technology.
Right.
Like sci-fi from like the 1920s or something, it's completely different than like sci-fi from the like 1960s, because the technology's changed. They didn't think about the idea of like projecting holograms and supercomputers and all that kind of stuff. And so that's the cool thing of like sci-fi, because eventually you can make new things because new technology comes available or like something like that.
Right. One of my favorite series is Black Mirror, and I love what they do because it's grounded sci-fi. They're taking what could be the very normal real world and adding like one little thing and exploring what this one little thing would cause. How would rating your interactions with every single person you meet change how we live our lives? And it's just such a fascinating thing. I kind of pulled a lot from that, among other grounded sci-fi, for Southbridge.
And you recorded it during the pandemic. How did you record at all? Like, how was like that whole process?
I should be sponsored by Zoom. So we did through Zoom, and then our actors had their own microphone setups so that we'd have this like high quality audio to then modify and put them in outer space or whatever. So each actor had their own setup, and then we would record them one at a time. So I'd get on a Zoom just like this, and we'd have our actor and our sound designer, Seth, and occasionally one other person to read through the lines with them. And we'd just, okay, line 4, give me a couple versions of this one. Oh, line 5, give me a couple versions of this one. So we would start with, let's just read the scene through so we get a flow for it. And then I'd let the actors decide, like, do you want me to read back with you? Or do you want to just like take each line and do it 5 times? And then I would be taking notes and go back and say, okay, I want to go back to line 13, say it like your mom just walked into the room, you know, like just like have all these different ways to try things because we're recording each actor separately. So if I love something that the actor tomorrow does, but it doesn't match the one way we did it with the actor today, and screwed. I'm constantly thinking like, okay, give me this 5 different ways. And once they're good, I have 5 choices to pair with the other person in the scene. It's a lot of work. It was a good boot camp trying to figure out how to get what I heard out of the actor and then letting them take the reins and come up with something even better. That happened a lot too.
And was there a reason in particular you decided not to do like group readings with the actors?
We did initial table reads once we cast everyone so that everyone at least could like see each other and hear each other. But all of our actors were all over the world. We had actors in Mexico, in London, all over the States, California, New York, Michigan, Nashville.
Logistic nightmare.
Yeah, everyone was spread out. And also COVID, you know, with SAG-AFTRA protocols, if you're in the room with someone, you've got to test everyone and you've got to follow all these things, including masks. It just like became a lot more expensive to do it in person. Had I had the money, I would love to do it in person. But for what we were trying to do, it made the most sense just to see what happens when everyone records on their own. And it worked out.
Did you have any like technical difficulties like with them recording on their end, with like they losing data or like a power outage? Yeah, that sucks.
Oh, yeah. All the things that you can imagine have happened. We lost a full day of recording with one person. You know, we thought we did an audio test before each recording session. And one of those audio tests, the test sounded great, but the whole session sounded awful. And so we had to go back and record their whole session. Anything you can imagine happened, but that's filmmaking, you know, like there's always fires to put out, problems to solve, mm-hmm. and you just adapt and move on.
Yeah, because like on a set, it's very contained. Like you have a lot more control over every little thing.
Sometimes.
Someone's house, like ideally, you have a lot more control.
Right, yeah.
You could have a million different things. The internet could be flaky. There could be someone knocking at their door while they're like recording. Very, very difficult, I can imagine.
Yeah.
Was everybody using their own software as well? Or did you guys have the same software amongst everyone?
Everyone was using their own software. A lot of our actors were using the same software, which made it really great because I'm not an audio person. That's why I insisted having someone that knew what they were doing on with me. So Seth kind of was on every call. He was monitoring all the tests as they came in and making sure like, oh, that line is going to pop because you popped your peas too loud, you know, so try it without the pee pop. There's just like things that I wouldn't have thought of. And now I know from doing the process, a bunch of little things like that.
So as a writer and director of the series, did you allow like any like ad-libbing or improvising or anything like that? I'm kind of curious if like a podcast, it's a little bit different than having someone improvise on a TV show or like a movie because they have body language they can do and stuff like that. From a podcast perspective, it's all audio driven. Did you allow any of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, we did a little bit because we added sound effects in after. There was a little bit of room to play. That being said, if we had recorded all of the other actors in the scene already, they're kind of locked into what, you know, what they say. But we did alternate lines on a lot of things. Say it this way and then use this word and use this word and we'll see which one is funniest. There were times where like our main actor, Danelle Leyva, cored him all of his lines first. And then we'd fill in all the rest of the actors. So we knew what he was going to do. And if he wanted to go off on a tangent and play around with all the lines, I wrote that down. Oh, I liked when he said this instead. And then we'd have other people react to those.
Did you do all the episodes at once or did you do it one episode at a time?
We did all of them at once.
Okay.
The full script was done. And then each episode or each session with our actors was 8 pages of lines. So whether that's episodes 1 through 8 or just episode 1, just depends on how many lines the actor has. But yeah, we would just hop on and knock out all 8 pages each time we recorded.
And what was like, besides obviously working in a Zoom environment, a pandemic environment, what was like some of the bigger challenges you faced with this project?
I mean, just the remote working was the biggest challenge. It's so weird to me that my cast has never met each other.
Yeah, that's kind of weird.
There are a few people that knew each other before the podcast, but most of the cast has never been in the same room together. So just trying to figure out how to let our actors in on this is the kind of personality they're bringing to the character. It's just a really tricky thing that you wouldn't have to do if you were on set. But overall, I mean, it was such a great experience. If we weren't remote working, I don't know what the problems, it would have just been on set normal problem. Oh, this person was late and the caterer didn't show up and we went over time because the PA forgot to pick up the actor on time, or, you know, whatever normal things happen.
And knowing what you know now, would you go back and redo it live or like in person with all your actors?
I wouldn't redo the season 1.
Okay.
If things were to align and a season 2 was commissioned, I would much rather record in person, but it's not impossible to do the way we did. If we had to, and I know things now that would make it a lot easier.
It would be like something in particular.
Being more specific about getting a variety of reactions, even nonverbal things like humps and
like a sigh,
and like, yeah, like we did, you know, a series of those, but there are some things I was like, we really need this little groan there. But like, as we went on with each session, like I started getting better and better about knowing like, that's how to get this actor to do this thing. And so now if I were to do a season 2, I would know going in, like Greg is this person. I know the character and I know who plays him and how that's going to feel versus as we were first starting out, we were finding the character, feeling out what made sense.
And I know it like shows and all, they record like B-roll and all just like that extra footage to kind of splice in there. Is that something you also do with like a podcast like this where you do get like a lot of that extra, just to have kind of that audio to use throughout?
Yeah. After each session or each scene, actually, we'd go through and Seth would say like, okay, I need the sound of you getting out of the truck and you falling down and you getting pushed. And so he would kind of like talk our actors through like, what does standing up sound like? And sometimes it was just like very odd, like, and you're like, I had to mute myself a couple times, just like, don't laugh. And it's like, they're trying to be a serious actor. And they're just like, funny, you know?
It is funny.
But yeah, we would go through all the different mouth noises that each scene required.
And the actors you worked with, have they ever done like a project like this previously? Like all like either like an audio drama or like something completely over like Zoom? Or is this new to them?
Some of them have. A couple of our actors are officially voice actors and do voice commercials or audiobooks or other podcasts. And so some of them came from a little bit of knowledge in that background. And then some of them have just acted on screen or on stage and were coming to this like, I don't know what I'm doing, but let's go for it. So having Amy, my producer, who also plays Brandy, having her there as kind of the middle ground. She's done a couple podcasts, audio dramas before. And so she's able to coach the actor on like, hey, don't go way big like you're on a theater stage. You don't have to do a whole lot and it's going to come across. So like your acting doesn't have to be big and over the top. It could just be the slightest little that makes all the difference.
Did you have like a lot of reshoots or was like everything you recorded with your actors, was that good enough?
Yeah, we had a couple pickups here and there, just different things in the edit. We're like, yeah, we don't have a take where she says it just right. And then we just like call up our actor. Hey, can you just say, get out of the truck a couple times, really sarcastic. And then we throw that in there. There were a couple times where we didn't have takes, but especially with the later episodes when we figured out how to direct the actors better and figured out how to get what I wanted out of them, it got easier and easier. So a lot of the pickups were from early episodes.
So where is that now in its life? I know you obviously wrapped on the first part of it. Are you mm-hmm. looking to possibly, I know you said briefly about season two. Have you started writing it? Have you started pitching it yet? Where is that kind of at?
So right now, we have ideas for season two. We have not started writing because our main push is to pitch it as a TV series, incorporating other storylines that aren't told in the podcast. So we want to go into the outside world and see Southbridge from the audience perspective and kind of play around with people on the outside, figuring out what's going on the inside versus the other way around. So that's kind of our TV series pitch that we're working on. Not saying no to season two, but definitely pushing for a visual medium because I feel like that's where this story deserves to live.
When you're writing a script or you're thinking about doing a new project, like how do you decide? Like I imagine you have a few ideas. Like how do you decide which ones to work on? And then like how do you go about writing? Do you have like a certain process that you go about or a routine or anything like that?
It changes with every project. With Southbridge, I was doing nothing and I wasn't working and was stuck at home because of quarantine. I was writing like 10 to 12 pages a day, just knocking things out, and then would hit up a friend and be like, hey, can you read this and make sure it makes sense before I move on to the next episode or whatever it was. With projects I'm doing now, it's just kind of I'll work on one until I'm tired of it, and then I'll switch and fine tune a short or look at notes for this pilot I wrote and just kind of like bounce between, okay, I'm really into this coming of age story right now. So that's what today is all about. And then I get tired of it and move on.
Is there kind of like a path or a vision that you have for a path towards like for your career? Is anything like that, like kind of guiding your decisions on I'm going to work on this or I'm going to do a short film now, or I want to try a feature, that kind of thing.
I'm a big supporter of you never know what's going to happen. So stop trying to plan it. But with that being said, you got to try to push for something. So right now I'm writing a loosely autobiographical coming of age story, a marching band underdog sports movie, essentially. And that's kind of my big push right now. It's like, I want to direct this feature. I want this to be my first feature. I already have producers on board. I just need to find the financing. So that's my next goal, is somehow find money to make this thing. And then I have my first feature and I'll figure out what to do from there. But as far as like overall goals, I don't know. I mean, like, I think I'd love to be a director, but at the same time, I might direct a few things and realize I hate it. And, you know, then I'll try something else. There's a big stigma on like, you have to stick with this thing because that's the thing that you decided you were going to be, when like a lot of people get tired of what they're doing. And instead of moving on to the next thing, they feel like they just have to keep going because this is what my life is now. but it doesn't have to be.
What's something you would like to see change in the industry?
I think a big thing right now, better working conditions, especially hours. In no other industry are people expected to work 12 plus hour days. And the unions are shifting it right now, but for the most part, 12 hour days are a standard.
14 plus is pretty common.
Yeah. In certain communities, it's up to 14, 16, 18. Like I've worked 18 hour days before and no one blinks an eye. And I'm like, this is crazy. And then you're supposed to get up and do it the next day and over and over and over again. That's not healthy. Your crew doesn't have a life. It's really terrible. And I love working on movies, but I don't want to work on movies if that's what we're supporting. It's a big thing that needs to change. And I think a lot of these accidents that happen on set would be prevented if people were well rested and, you know, were able to like take care of their mental health so that they could come on set, not just pick up a gun and hand it to the actor and not think about it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's like, I know there is unions. I mean, but like you still hear about like those balls to the wall for like a week of like 20 hour days to get the show done in time. Like it's so hard and all like I can't imagine doing that.
The unions, and maybe IATSE will come after me for this, but I don't really care at this point. The unions make it so that productions can work their crews that long, but they just have to pay more. When you're dealing with certain production companies that have all the money they could ever wish for, they don't care. They'll just throw dollars at anything.
Yeah.
It's not helping the problem, really. There needs to be a cutoff. Like, you may not work your crew for 12 hours. And if you do, they get to walk at 12 hours, no matter what you're doing. And then getting the crew on board, because so many crew members are like, no, I don't want to let down this person. And it goes up the chain. So the first AC doesn't want to abandon their operator. The operator doesn't want to abandon the DP. The DP doesn't want to abandon the director, and so on and so forth. And so you have this like allegiance that lets abuse just keep happening. And it just needs to be an across the board. This is the standard, no exceptions.
It's what is industries as well. Like it's relatively cutthroat, and like someone would jump in your seat in a heartbeat. So like there will always be another person to fill in your shoes.
They definitely have leverage because of that, I think.
Yeah.
There's an environment that is sacrifice yourself for the sake of the project.
It's a badge of honor. Like it's
whatever it takes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, my first ever job on set that I was paid for, I heard that, the lenses need to be held onto while the truck is driving through town in the middle of the night. And I was like, they need to be held down. Let me jump into the back of this truck and hold the lenses while we're like speeding through town. And then like, it didn't hit me until like years later. I was like, that was really dumb. Look how much they care.
Right.
And that's not okay. And definitely a lot of those feelings started coming out as Southbridge came to a close and I was writing the finale. It was, this is what this is really about. And I didn't realize it while I was writing it. Even though I knew how it was going to end, I didn't realize what I was trying to say until I had written it. And I was like, that's the problem.
It's very, very hard industry. People overlook it and all because it's like the magic of Hollywood and all that. But it's it's grueling. It's very, very, very hard work.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that like everybody is working hard.
Yeah. Manual labor.
No, it's like, entire teams. It's not just isolated. Like if you talk to actors and like they talk about like work conditions and like that kind of stuff, definitely like your department, even like the people working digital effects and special effects and all that, like it's a very demanding industry. And
yeah, there's certain times when it's just like, I don't care what it's going to take. We just need to get this shot tonight.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have people walking around half asleep because they've been up for 18 hours, 6 days in a row. And what are the odds that they're going to trip on a stand and fall off a cliff or something? You know, it can happen. It's scary, you know.
Yeah. Do you have any ambitions of acting or anything like that? Or are you pretty much good with not acting?
I'm very much behind the camera. I took an acting class in college, acting for non-majors. I was doing a lot of working in film and I was about to direct my first short and was like, I want to learn what it's like to be on the other side. And so I took this acting class and I learned some great tricks and tools and knew that I would never act. I definitely have stage fright. And so when all the spotlights and all the lenses and everything are on me, I like shut down. Yeah, definitely no. I have so much respect for actors though. Like some people look at actors and they're like, oh, that's easy. They just go play make-believe. And it's such a technical, really complex thing that they can do, especially the good actors and especially comedy actors. Being funny is not easy.
Probably say the same thing about stuff you do, like, oh, you're just pointing a camera. Most people just say that's like basically your job, but like you have all the focusing, you have to worry about the lighting, the marks, and like it's almost like scientific and all with the amount of work that goes into that side of the industry. It's just so much work and all to make these come to fruition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've lost a lot of respect for critics from doing this podcast and learning.
Fuck critics. They're the shit bags. It's so hard shitting on someone, like they're putting like all this heart and soul into it. It's not just one person. Like, it's crazy, teams of people. And like, oh,
I can't imagine having the audacity to tell anyone that their project was horrible, you know, when they... knowing how much work went into it.
The fact that anything gets made is a miracle. It is so difficult, even just to get a script written. And then you got to sell it and you got to hire a bunch of people and then you got to shoot it. And then you got to get it all through post. So many movies die in post because they can't find the right editor or they realize they don't have the right footage and they can't afford to go back and shoot. So they just call it. It's a miracle that anything gets completely made. So... to go out and just say like, oh, that was bad. Like, okay, rude. Let me see you make something better. But also like, it wasn't your thing. You know, it could be someone else's thing. Yeah, I don't love superhero movies. I know people love them. It's not my thing. I'm not going to call Wonder Woman horrible. Because it was well done for what it was. I just don't care for it.
There's so many projects too that get railed by critics and like a lot of people really enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like you'll go on Rotten Tomatoes and the critic score is like 40 and then it's 95%, you know, for the audience.
And even like some of my all-time favorite movies, like movies that just blew me away as a kid and definitely as an adult. Like you hear the horror stories about like these movies barely were made and like there's so many problems and all that. And like you don't see that in the final product of it. And that's where I think a lot of the real magic is all that.
It's kind of cool to watch somebody who's just starting out or trying to figure things out do something as well, because you can kind of give some insight into the process of getting good at something. You know what I mean? So like I think there's value in all of it.
I love finding student filmmakers who are, you know, just playing with all the things. Oh, we're going to go make this black and white noir thing because I like noir movies. Seeing just totally unfiltered, like, I just want to make this thing. I have a handful of kids right now that will send me things and it's so fun just to see where they are and each video gets better and better. And it's so exciting because you can see their style coming out. It's a lot of fun to watch new filmmakers try out different things and find their voice.
It's interesting too. Like it seems when you're making film, it's like each project is kind of as a unit, like a piece of learning as well. But then you also have like the day-to-day skills and like there's so many different skills that are involved. It's kind of interesting because like some skills, like, you know, like comedy, you can just go up on stage, you know, if there's a stage available, you know, like, so there's like, you can make incremental progress, but it seems like with filmmaking, it's like project by project, you know, that you make this progress. So it seems like it might be harder to get good at it.
It's really tricky. And like, there's a big debate. Oh, everyone has a phone, so they have a camera. So just go out and shoot stuff. And it's like, yes, but you're limited. You're not going to have access to the best actors. You're not going to have access to the best lighting. You're not going to have access to perfect location. So when you get all of those things, you're like in this, I have to make every moment count because I have all of this stuff finally. You know, so there's a lot of adrenaline that goes into each shoot and you're just trying to absorb as much and learn as much as you can. It's a limited amount of time that you have, whatever kind of production exists. So for me, like I wanted to work with a bunch of actors. My last short was purposefully one actor, limited dialogue, because I wanted to figure out how to tell the story visually, you know, not have the dialogue lead the whole thing. And then with Southridge, it was, I want to work with a bunch of actors and I want to just like explore group dynamics and multiple people in a room talking at the same time feels and figure out all of those fun things too. But you don't get that unless you have thousands of dollars, you know.
Kind of mindful with the projects that you take on. You're thinking about like a particular skill set that you're working on. You might not think about it in that way, but it sounds like you're kind of doing that. Yeah.
I think after the fact I realized what I do, you know. So like my first one, it was I have access to this location. So I'm gonna get two actors because that's what I can afford and they're gonna have a conversation in the location. And then it was let's tell the story visually. It's just one actor and he's gonna say as little as possible and I'll see what happens. So yeah, each project, I think after the fact, I realized that was the thing I was working on.
No Cleaner Threads was really cool, by the way. I think that's one you
thank you.
Mentioned. Yeah, enjoyed that.
Some people are like embarrassed by some of their first stuff and I'm still so proud of that.
That's awesome.
It was a fun little short and some of my best friends were working on it with me and it was exactly what I envisioned when I was writing it. And that was the first feeling of like, oh, this directing thing is cool.
One of the things I did notice, you worked on Stranger Things for an episode, it looks like, right?
Yeah. So freelancing with the company that I'm now full-time with, we do VFX driving plate work. So in driving scenes, everything that happens outside the window, we shoot. So the production will pull a car onto a stage and put up a green screen wall or an LED wall. And then they'll hire us to go out and rig a 360 camera rig onto a car and drive a specific route. And then they take our footage and place it on the LED or the green screen.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's really cool. Yeah.
So it's like this weird little niche part of the market, but we're one of two Netflix recommended companies now and we shoot for everyone under the sun, you know? So it's really neat to work for a company that's just found the thing that they do and it's we're the best at it, arguably. I'm a little biased, but
is the LED screens becoming more popular because we've been hearing a lot more about that recently?
Yeah, it's becoming quite a big thing. Our sister company, The Car Stage, just opened one in Long Island City here in Queens, and all of the productions come in and they're not quite sure how to use it. And by the end of their day of shooting, they're like, I never want to shoot anywhere else. We had a conversation with a production recently that was like, we want you guys to go into this field and shoot a 360 environment. And then we're just going to shoot sunset for 2 days straight on the car stage. And it's like, great. You know, like it's easy for us. It makes their life so much better than rather than like chasing sunlight every day for 2 weeks to be able to get this 15-page scene done. It's being used in really exciting ways aside from just driving stuff. And I think it's really going to transform the way productions work, but they have to understand it and accept it first. And that's the tricky part is being able to teach productions how to use it, what it's good for, what it's not good for, and how to innovate within what we know.
Yeah, I'm sure there's like a percentage of like companies that are kind of set in their ways and like adopting these new technologies. Because like even like earlier we were talking about lenses, like you said, like the new lenses are perfectly fine. There's no reason to not use a new lens, but there are certain directors that want to really focus on those older lenses for whatever nostalgic reason. But like that's the cool thing with technology, definitely shaping not just the film and movie industry, but just everything in general. It's really cool.
Yeah, I mean the car rig company I work for, they've been around for about 12 years. And just recently have we seen like a major uptick. Oh, this is so much easier than renting a big trailer to park a car on top of and then having two cops drive along sides and block off all the traffic and then bring in stunt drivers. And it's silly.
Yeah, it's drastically cheaper. That's all they care about.
Yeah. The ticket seems a bit high initially, and then you start calculating how much it would be to do it practically, and it just doesn't make sense anymore.
Stuntmen are on their way out, huh?
Not necessarily. I mean, there's still, we work with a lot of stunt drivers still. We've done stuff for like SWAT and Lethal Weapon. Mm-hmm. Our car rig drives the route and we just put a stunt driver in instead of one of our drivers. And they do all of their crazy stunts with our car rig so that they have these, you know, like donuts in a parking lot or hard brakes to simulate a crash into a bomb truck or, you know, whatever it is. So they still exist. It's just we're trying to make it safer for the actors and just more feasible for productions when it's not some big complex thing, when you just need downtown LA at night with no other cars around. That's hard to do when you have a production of 250 people. But when it's just like some randos with a car, pretty easy.
And I know you said you don't really care for superhero movies, but do you have any like dream franchises or anything in particular you're just dying to get on?
It's a hard thing because you know how they say don't meet your heroes.
Yeah.
I feel like I've worked on a handful of things and have been disappointed.
Do you have a Bruce Campbell story as well?
I do.
All right.
Well, I have some opposite Bruce Campbell stories too. Okay. Like I've worked with so many actors that are so wonderful, but not at all what I expected. The show I worked on, the last AC job that I did, was with Daniel Radcliffe and Steve Buscemi. And I was like, these are faces that I've been seeing on TV since I was a kid. Like, this is insane. And they were the most genuine humans I've ever worked with.
That's awesome.
Like, yeah. Daniel made it a point to like go up and have a conversation with everyone on set. There's like 250 people plus all the cast. So many people. And he knew my name. We had a whole conversation. We actually talked about Southbridge.
That's so cool.
It was just like, you could tell that he just is a normal person, just wants to hang out and is curious about other people. So it was very assuring that not all actors are awful. But I have worked with actors. When I was second ACing, I laid a green mark for a certain actor. And he looked up at me and was so offended that I would mark him in green, because apparently green is a bad luck color and everyone knows this. He was like, are you trying to like give me a death wish? Like, he was livid because I marked him with green tape. But no, I mean, I've worked with actors who are just really abusive to their assistants, or
that's really shitty,
just awful in general, don't care about the crew and all of the hard work they're putting into it because they're the only people that matter on set. And it's like, fun.
They must derive like all their self-worth from their position.
I think it's a level of insecurity. And like, if I don't show that I'm this important person, people aren't going to think I'm important or whatever it is. But to that same point, acting is such a vulnerable craft, and you have to just like have all of these emotions ready to go at the flip of a switch. I understand, you know, when you hear these actors like blow up on set, you're like, ooh, juicy audio from the mixer, you know. But I get it, because you know they're supposed to be angry in this next scene, so they've like done whatever they need to do to get into that mode, and then someone does something that ticks them off a little bit and there's the switch. You know, being able to control that switch is difficult and not impossible, but you're asked to do this thing all the time. Sometimes you can't control the switch.
Well, that makes sense.
So what would be your dream franchise though, if you choose?
I want to say like travel documentary stuff, okay. But then I've worked on travel documentary stuff and it's a pain because you get no sleep. You kind of get to see the place you're in, but not really. I don't know. I mean, I think that's why I do so many different things, because I find joy in all of the different things that I work on. You know, I've worked on a kids movie and it's so fun just to see kids with just unleash this energy, especially when you can like aim it at the right emotion and they just like go hard. I worked with this 8-year-old on a movie called Cecil, and there's a scene where he wakes up from a nightmare and has to just like bawl, and he did it and it was incredible. And I've never seen an adult actor be able to do that so well. And it's so fun to just like witness young talent like that. But then travel stuff is awesome. You know, you get to see the coolest things and eat the coolest food. And
yeah.
And then you have your big explosions and car crashes, and there's a whole level of excitement and stress to that too. I don't know. I like all the things.
No. I always have a hard, like when I think about this question, I always like, I wouldn't be able to choose one thing just because like you're passionate about so many different things, especially different. I'm sure like you would love to direct one thing, but you would love to shoot another thing or produce like another, like it's, that's the cool thing about the industry. Like it's just magical.
Yeah. When I'm like asked to DP stuff, a lot of time it's like, does this script speak to me? Do I feel like I have a voice as a visual director with this story? And if I don't, I'm probably not the right job for me. You should find someone that is connected to the story. Or other times I take the job because I love the director, I love the crew, and I'm just like, I'm here for it. Just tell me what to do and I'll do it, you know. End up finding that excitement and joy through their excitement for it.
We usually ask one last question of our guests. Any words of wisdom for someone aspiring to get into the industry that you wish you would have got when you first started?
I had a go-to response for this, and it has changed within the last year.
Okay.
My new response is set boundaries, take care of yourself. If you need a day off, take a day off, because there will always be more work. It's so easy to be worried about your paycheck constantly and forget that you have a life and you should enjoy it too. That's my new go-to phrase. But my old one was similar to a previous guest you had on, which is work hard and be nice. It shows your attitude on set is more important than any skill you'll ever learn. So if you show up and you're happy to be there and you prove that you're going to work hard, you'll work in this industry. If you can't do that, you might work, but people aren't going to like you, and that's no fun.
Yeah. Tiffany, it's been an absolute blast to have you on our podcast this evening. We really do appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been cool.
Been really fun chatting with you guys.
Where can our listeners find more of you and your work at?
My personal Instagram is tmurraycamera. Southbridge is Southbridge Podcast on Instagram and Southbridge Cast on Twitter. And you can find Southbridge anywhere you listen to podcasts, Apple, Spotify, and everywhere else.
Yeah, definitely recommend. This is good.
All right, Tiffany, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you tonight. We really do appreciate
it. Great meeting you. We're excited for everything you got going on.
Thanks, guys. Thanks,
have a good one, Tiffany. Yeah, she was awesome.
Yeah, she's great.
Really, really enjoyed that.
It's cool.
Because you wouldn't think like something as simple as like focusing the camera and getting like, getting that those marks and stuff like that is so critical and crucial, but it is.
You can see in her short the no cleaner threads, like the shots there, they look very calculated. One part of it, like the main character is like taking like detergent out of a dispenser, and it's like you see the whole thing, but like the only thing that's in focus is like one, just the line that's in it. Like it's a lot more interesting, like that level of detail.
And like I know we touched on like earlier in the episode about like it kind of feels like it's a math problem to some extent. It's one of those things where like, oh, we're using geometry and all these, like math is so important. That's why it is very important to learn math and all, because it's, you have to know like, all right, this is 2 feet away. And then this is, you kind of treat these things as like a math problem when you're shooting.
Definitely your spatial awareness has to be at another level.
Reminds me of like in college and all, I was doing like crime scene stuff where it's like super math intensive, like blood splatter patterns and trajectory of like bullets and shit like that.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's all pure math and all. And that's what this reminds me of, where it's very calculated.
It's almost like math shows up in everything. It's interesting, like the different skill sets that you bring when you start directing, you know, like what your strengths are and how that translates into what you're able to accomplish.
Yeah, I always hear like actors talk about like directors, like there's kind of like there's the actor's director, or there's like the more like technical directors and shit. And I think that's like really what she was saying, like her co-director that one time was an actress, and like she understood, like that's what she was looking at. She was looking at like the facial expressions, making sure like the actors were like saying stuff right, where she was looking at the technical aspect of it, making sure it was in focus and the scene was hitting. I do think like having like different skill sets is very, very powerful, if at all, because like, I don't think a director can just come off the street and like fucking start directing shit. Like you do need some kind of a background, either in more of the technical side of it or more of the acting side. Because she's done like so much like writing, directing, the cinematography stuff. But also the podcast is like a complete 180 from a lot of that, because there's no visual component to it.
It was cool. It was like a shortcut for her to get access to working with actors as well. Like a lot of them, you know, because like like the cost, the barrier to entry was a lot lower.
Yeah,
I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, because you can do like a lot. I mean, it's funny, you can do a lot, but like it's also such a limited medium as well with podcasting, because there's no visual elements to it. But yeah, like there's a lot of like atmosphere you have to build, and the sound and the way people say stuff. And I like the way she described, like over like a TV show, you would just say, "Hey, how's it going?" You would say, "Hey, Jim, how's it going?" Or like there's no, like it's those extra steps. Is like, because you wouldn't really think about it when you're writing it, because you're just writing the scene. Like Josh and Seamus are talking. Obviously, you know Josh is talking to Seamus in a podcast. Like you kind of do need to announce that a little bit.
I like mediums that have a lower barrier of entry, because you can explore a lot more ideas in there. Or either not necessarily a barrier to entry, but like, because I was thinking of novels. That's a pretty big barrier, but you can do anything in a novel, anything that you can describe or imagine. Most things that we can imagine are linguistically expressible anyway. So like we can, you know, you can write it out.
But on the flip side, though, there's quite a lot you can't do in a novel, where you do need like that visual element to kind of showcase that. I mean, Because either you can't describe it well enough, or like there's too much going on. Like you ever like reading like car crashes or like a fight scene in like a book just doesn't hit nearly as well as it does in an actual like visual medium.
Some people are really good at visualizing what they're reading. I've never been one of those people, but like I've heard people tell me that when they read, it's literally like the reading rainbow, like where they open the book and they're in another world. So I think some people are able to imagine at a much higher level. Like I've never been one of those people. When I read a book, it's kind of imagining things in less than black and white.
You use that shit imagination then.
I'm able to visualize things pretty well. Like that lends itself to math and stuff. But as far as, I think it's a level of focus too. It's gotten better lately.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
That's good to hear.
I've been doing these meditations where I focus on my third eye.
Jesus fucking Christ. Yeah, no, Tiffany was cool as fuck. Yeah, definitely excited to see more of her work and all. It's really cool. The stuff she's worked on and done and is doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you all for listening. If you would like to support the WWSD podcast, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/WWSD_podcast. Make sure you like and subscribe on our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
I woke up in the middle of the night and was like, I have to rewrite the ending. And I rewrote his last scene the night before we recorded it because I was like, I know what I'm trying to say now. I've had that experience happen a couple times where I wake out of a dead sleep. I have the idea.
That's awesome.
It's so exhilarating.
Sometimes I I start asking a question and I'm like, I don't even know what I'm trying to ask. You know, I'm like, it's a journey to just get to a question sometimes.
Imagine a 280-page question.